You're listening to an edited version of the live Voices of Montana statewide radio program. Find us on Facebook and subscribe for further podcasts wherever you get your audio on demand. I'm Tom Schultz, host of the program. Thanks for joining us, and please feel free to contact me at studio@voicesofmontana.com. Rob Nadelson is with us here, the professor, a senior fellow in constitutional jurisprudence, the Independence Institute, Denver, Colorado. We've had him on the program a number of times to talk various constitutional issues over the years. Have something right in front of us today with this Waters of the U.S. ruling, which Rob has looked into in the past. And Rob, thanks again for being here. You're doing well?
You don't have to thank me. I just love being in Montana. We spend as much time as we possibly can here. Got family here. And I use the excuse of family to spend as much time in the state as I can.
Yeah, that's good. And I understand you'll be getting around to, I love to do that as well. There's just so many places in Montana.
Yeah,
I love
really
every
are.
Inch of it. Yeah,
really are. I mean, I was talking to Taylor Brown. One of the things we'd like to do is to spend some time around Lewistown. I mean, Lewistown has always been one of my favorite places in the state. And we're thinking of maybe going up there in August and exploring some of the island mountain ranges, yeah, like the Judiths, for example, or the Big Snowies or the Little Snowies. There are some beautiful and very interesting places there, and they're not known to most people. They're not even known to most Montanans.
I know, and the folks in Lewistown are going, shh.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Sorry, guys.
Yeah. That's the word's out anyway, and we're happy for you there. I don't know where you want to start. There's a lot of places to go here, but we've got this ruling that came out today. As I said, I think it's simply put, the Biden administration is reversing the Trump administration, which is reversing the Obama administration's ruling or policy directives regarding Waters of the U.S. And you guys have looked into this as part of the Independence Institute.
Yeah, let's unpack this. The Constitution gives to Congress the power to regulate commerce among the several states. That's the famous Commerce Clause. And then in addition, the Constitution gives to Congress the power to pass laws which shall be necessary and proper to carry out other powers, including the commerce power. And so it has always been understood that under the commerce power, Congress has the power to regulate navigable streams where you can actually, move boats up and down. But in a classic case of mission creep, what has happened is that over the years, the federal government has constantly expanded their power over streams to include not just navigable waters, but also waters that feed navigable waters, waters that feed navigable waters, waters that might feed navigable waters, except that they don't. But because they don't, that's somehow deemed to affect navigable water. You get the point.
Yeah.
Right. And so the Army Corps of Engineers and the EPA have imposed restrictions on farmers and other landowners, have sued them over their proposals to manage what amount to mud puddles, calling them wetlands, claiming that they somehow feed navigable water. So the U.S. Supreme Court, back in the early 2000s, called a halt to this by interpreting the relevant environmental statute in a way that was fairly narrow, because it said, if you're governing mud puddles, that really is beyond the scope of the Commerce Clause. So we're going to interpret federal law narrowly to make sure that it is constitutional. Then the Trump administration issued regulations that told EPA and the Army Corps of Engineers to back up. Don't regulate mud puddles on the grounds that it's navigable waters. Well, predictably, the Biden administration has reversed. The Trump administration, one of the difficulties I had with the Trump administration is that they did some good things, but they tended to do good things that were easily reversible. And this was one of them.
Right.
What they needed to do is they needed to rewrite the law and make it narrower, but they didn't do it. So we're going to be litigating again, I'm sure. I'm sure that Mountain States Foundation, maybe the Institute for Justice and others will bring a landowner's case up into the federal courts. And I'm hopeful that the current Supreme Court will simply say flat out that federal regulation of waters other than navigable waters is unconstitutional, period.
Will, can, how? does that happen? Because as you talked about, there were previous Supreme Court cases that kind of went short of giving that final ruling. Is it just a matter of court makeup?
There's a principle that many judges follow. It's called the principle of avoidance or the principle of deference. And it basically means that if there's any way to uphold a law as constitutional, any reasonable way whatsoever, then you uphold it. That's why Obamacare was upheld, using a rather exotic interpretation of individual mandate. And so you're right. I mean, the courts have avoided a confrontation with Congress on this issue. But there's some areas that are developing. This is one. Roe versus Wade is another, where the rubber is hitting the road. The fist is hitting the jaw, whatever metaphor you want to use, where the court is going to have to confront these issues squarely. And I think this is probably one of them.
Your book, The Original Constitution, What It Actually Said and Meant, comes into play here. Because you in that, and it reads much, I think it reads much easier and nicer and more friendly than you might give it credit for. I really enjoy reading it just from that standpoint.
Thank you, Tom.
Available
at BarnesandNoble.com and Amazon.com.
That's right. Yeah, I got it right here on my Kindle, too, for that matter, yeah. Which I appreciate. Will the Supreme Court need to go back to what navigable waters meant in the original Constitution?
Yeah. If you go look at the original Constitution, the short answer to your question is yes. I mean, all justices now sitting on the court, even the liberal ones, will listen carefully to what the original meaning of a clause was. This isn't like back in the 60s and 70s where the court just always made up the law as it went along. And I say went along, it didn't much care about what the Constitution really means. All the justices, even the most liberal like Sotomayor, will listen seriously to an originalist argument. And the question becomes, what does regulate commerce among the several states mean, as opposed to not commerce, like farming is not commerce? Or what does among the several states mean as opposed to simply within Montana? And so they're going to have to answer those questions. Now, it is established that in the founding era, the term regulate commerce did include regulate navigation, and that also included regulating waters. You know, some ignorant law professors tell their students that when Chief Justice John Marshall back in the early 1800s expanded the Commerce Clause to navigation, this was expansive interpretation of the Constitution. That's not true. Navigation was always understood to be part of regulating commerce. The problem is when you get into waters that are not navigable waters. You know, that a small trout stream where you can't float anything much more than a fly, you know? And so the argument that they flow into navigable waters and therefore affect navigable waters is really stretched. The founders understood that non-navigable waters affect navigable ones. They understood that. They understood that agriculture affects commerce and all the world is interrelated. But they decide to draw a line. The line they drew is the feds have gotten certain powers and the rest is reserved to the states and people. And so the feds get to control net waters you can navigate, and the states and the people get to control the smaller waters. So that's the kind of thing that if a case goes before the Supreme Court, we would be interested in submitting a brief to inform the court about.
Yeah, and you should talk. Rob Nadelson is with us, professor, a former professor at the University of Montana. I call him the professor. A lot of years, also, as I say, a public figure in Montana with conservatives. I think you sort of defined Montana's conservative movement in the early 90s and through that period as well.
You're very kind.
Yeah, well, I think it's true. I mean, and talking about taxing and spending, I think you were calling out Republicans for...
Yeah, just to explain that. Back before the year 2000 or so, much of the Republican Party in Montana had a long progressive history, something like the New York or the Minnesota Republican parties that have been very heavily influenced by that model of progressive Republicanism. And I'm a conservative Republican, and I did battle with progressive Republicans in our own party and was given a lot of credit for changing the dialogue. So now today, while Republicans differ among themselves, most of them really are conservative.
Well, in fact, successful, we can mention now, because we're talking about it, in repealing a tax increase that was set forth and approved by the legislature.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I mean, at the time, we're talking now early 90s, late 80s, Montana legislature passed a tax increase just about every 2 years. They'd pass a tax increase, the economy would sink because of the tax increase, then they'd run a deficit and they'd pass another tax increase. And we were really in a vicious circle. I mean, or use another figure of speech, we were being sucked into a whirlpool. Mm. We had gone from one of the richer states in the country to 47th in the nation in per capita income. We were dead last in wages. And so something had to be done. And we finally managed to get the tax burden under control. We reduced the income tax, and Montana's done a lot better since that time. So, that was the focus of what. Now, the irony is that when I left the University of Montana to carry out a national consulting practice, I had to move back to Colorado. And Colorado had traditionally been a more libertarian state.
Wow.
And now it's been taken over by the hard left.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like I come up here to Montana again for a breath of freedom.
and there's a warning in that as well.
There is a warning. There is a warning. I mean, you know, eternal vigilance is the price of liberty.
Rob Nadelson is with us. You know, we're going to line up some phone calls, too, if you want to join us at 866-627-5483. Constitutional questions, 866-627-5483. We'll get that lined up here in just a little bit. I don't think I have enough time to kind of launch into this a little bit, so we'll just finish up with Waters of the U.S. and the Independence Institute. It'll be you're pretty sure that this is an issue that your organization, is going to try to get involved.
Yeah, one of the things we do, Independence Institute is a free market think tank. It's located in Denver, Colorado, but we're interested in national issues. At least our law division is. So we submit briefs to federal courts and to the Supreme Court on important issues. For example, in the school choice case that came out of Montana, it was decided in favor of school choice last July. Our brief was cited, and my article was personally referenced by Justice Alito. And so we'll weigh in on our cases like this. And I'm sure that, you know, I can't speak for the boss on this issue, but I speak with a 90-degree level of confidence that Waters of the United States is something we'd be very interested in weighing in on.
We'll certainly follow that and look forward to that. We'll come on back with more. Again, if you want to join us, give that number out, 866-627-5483. You can text us, too, at 781-627-5483. A lot of things on the plate here with Professor Rob Nadelson today on Voices of Montana. You know, we'll talk more about Waters of the U.S., this recent decision by the Biden administration with Kristen Wohlgemuth. She is the president and CEO of the Mountain States Legal Foundation. She is also in Montana. We'll stop by in studio tomorrow. We'll also have Governor Greg Gianforte on to discuss that issue. Rob Nadelson is with us, the professor in studio here, as I mentioned, with the Independent Institute, involved in filing amicus briefs on behalf of that institute. And also just a long history in Montana, former University of Montana law professor and public figure, too. We've got a call. Let's go to that right now. It's 781-627-5483 on the text or 866-627-5483. But Casey, joining us in Great Falls and KQDI, 1450 AM. Good morning, Casey. You're
Hi,
on
Casey.
The air.
Casey. How are you?
Yeah, good morning. I wanted the professor to speak on private property rights. I have developed land and over the last 25 years, and every time you go through a phase of development, there's more burdens placed upon the process and on the land and what you can do with it, and regulations. It comes from the very top down through and filters through every level of government under the federal government. And I got to the point where and also one last point, it impinges upon every level of expense, and the cost is infiltrated and insinuated into everything you do with a house, because they're not making any more land, and the final analysis, everything has to set on real property. So, having said that, private property impingements and burdens on a title create a great incentive to inflate costs, and you can really see it, not just in the monetary policies, but also in the actual environmental policies. So private property is becoming less and less private is the bottom line.
Thank you, Casey.
Well, you're preaching to the choir. You know, before I was a law professor, I practiced a number of years in real estate, and I had a real estate license, in fact, a brokerage license, although I didn't trade actively. Then I taught property law at the University of Montana for 20 years. People are in politics are forever talking about the need for affordable housing. But as Casey says, that one reason you don't have enough affordable housing is that the government makes it impossible to build at a cost that's affordable. And then they'll maybe put up some kind of tenements and for people to live in and claim that's affordable housing. It's a classic government trying to cure a problem that the government created and making the problem worse. But there's another issue here that Casey didn't mention that I think I need to add to that. Freedom requires having centers of power, centers of wealth, influence outside the government. When people own property, it's a lot harder for the government to push them around. If people have resources that they can use to lobby, to participate in politics, to influence policy, to work in their community to make the community better, then that means they're freer people. And private property is an important key to that. One way to enslave people is to take away their property. And this is something I think that people in government don't understand. I mean, when you complain about a regulation, the answer is sort of always the same. Well, you know, we all have to property rights are not absolute. They have to yield to the public good and so forth. Well, I'm afraid we've gone long beyond the point where property right where we're protecting the public good. What we're doing is we are oppressing property owners and essentially attacking them for the benefit of certain political constituencies. And end of speech.
No, not quite, because, you know, the citizenry is to balance the power of the federal government. And if we are if we're neutered in our ability to
That's right.
I think there's only one way down that road.
Right. You can have a nominal democracy, a democracy in name only, where the people vote. But if the people don't have property, if they don't have ways of being independent from the government, or put another way, if they're all dependent upon the government, they just vote as the government tells them to. You know, Tom, this came up the last time I was on. We talked about D.C. statehood.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Washington, D.C., you've got all of these people dependent directly or indirectly on the federal government, and so they always vote in presidential elections for more government power. They're really not free agencies, and property rights are one way of assuring the citizens are free.
And thereby they're often attacked.
That's right.
Yeah.
I mean, and you think of the progressive left agenda. I mean, who do they go after? They go after organized religion. They go after property rights. They go after corporations. They go after farmers and ranchers. They go after the states. The reason they go after all these groups is that they represent centers of power independent of the central government. What they want is a world in which each individual stands naked before the power of the state. And property rights are one key to making sure that doesn't happen.
And our Constitution still defends us in that endeavor that needs defense. One of the things we'll talk about when we come on back is you're a commentator for a lot of publications, the Denver Post, the American Spectator, Wall Street Journal for
Spectator.
One. Spectator. Thank you.
Some people would say it's a specter. Yeah. Mostly it's the Epoch Times.
And the Epoch Times. And you've been doing a series there called Defending the Constitution. So we'll come on back and ask,
sure.
Does the Constitution need to be defended? All right, welcome back. It is 866-627-5483, or text us here at 781-627-5483. From Montana, for Montana, Voices of Montana, and former host on the program, Professor Rob Nadelson, Senior Fellow at Constitutional Jurisprudence at the Independence Institute. You can just search it Independence Institute, or it is the number 2i.org for more information. I tease you about one of the articles we had talked about when you've been on over the past couple of years, Lies Law Professors Tell. I still think that that's just a great title. Let's talk about a series that you're doing for Epoch Times called Defending the Constitution. Yep. Why do we need to defend the Constitution? I thought the Constitution defended us. Maybe that's why we need to defend it.
Well, we need to defend it because it's under attack. It's been under attack for many, many years, a century, really. With the rise of the progressive movement, progressives had the view that restraints on government power were not a good idea because progress required a government that does not restrain so that the government could legislate however it deemed best for the interests of the people. That's the progressive theory. And a part of that theory also is that a lot of areas of life should be run by experts, again, backed with the power of government. Philosophy of the Constitution is very different. Probably all listeners are aware that the Constitution fragments power between the legislature, the executive, and the judicial branches. And it also fragments power between the states and the federal government. And in addition to that, and this is something that very few people know, the Constitution actually gives certain powers to independent entities, such as the Electoral College, or certain conventions outside the federal government. And so the philosophy of the Constitution is to fragment powers. So naturally, the Constitution has been under attack from people who don't want to fragment powers. And one of the things that they do to attack the Constitution is tell falsehoods about it. I won't call them lies because in many cases they don't know they're not telling the truth. Mm. For example, one example of a falsehood is the Constitution was put together by and for a bunch of slaveholders. And it was, you know, just a document based on slavery by people who believed in a caste system in the United States. Absolutely not true. There were 55 framers who drafted the Constitution. Most of them did not own slaves. Even some of them who did own slaves, like George Mason and James Madison, favored emancipation of the slaves. And then when the Constitution was ratified, it was ratified by 1,648 delegates in the 13 states. Overwhelmingly, they did not own slaves. And those delegates were elected by an electorate, 95% of which didn't own slaves. So the Constitution itself created a mechanism whereby the country was seen as on the way to the abolition of slavery. So this is a good example of a falsehood about the Constitution, that it's a pro-slavery document. And that's the kind of thing I'm responding to in my column in my columns on defending the Constitution.
All right, I'm going to ask, we got a breakup coming here just in about 30 seconds. So that's going to set the stage for further delving into this a little bit. Are we defending the Constitution well enough?
That's easy to answer, isn't it?
It's probably, yeah.
But
yeah.
Let's answer it on the other side.
And then what do we need to do better then if that answer presumably is no? We'll come on back with Rob Nadelson here. It's from Montana for Montana. And again, 781-627-5483 on the text line.
You're listening to a podcast from the live Voices of Montana radio show. Be sure to check out the full podcast page at voicesofmontana.com for a full listing of all our programs. We've been covering Montana issues for more than 20 years. Thanks for listening
Voices
today.
Of Montana with Tom Schultz.
Pleasure to have Rob in studio. Professor Rob Nadelson, Senior Fellow in Constitutional Jurisprudence from the Independence Institute. You'll find a lot of his writing, as I mentioned, in these publications, Washington Post, The Washington Times, The American. I'm just going to go with Spectre, The Wall Street Journal, Barron's Daily Caller, and Epoch Times, which I've...
By the way, Tom, we should tell listeners, you and I go back a long way. I mean, in 1997, I started hosting a talk show in Missoula, which we eventually took...
Statewide?
Statewide. Yeah. It's the ancestor to this show. And I always knew you were engineering for us most of the time. And I always knew when you were engineering, because when you were engineering, things went right. And when anybody else was engineering, things went wrong. And so I'm really glad to see that you're now hosting your show, your statewide show yourself.
Well, radio, it gets in your blood, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Radio's a great medium.
You do a lot of radio interviews across the country, don't you?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I've done in the last year, for example. I've probably done radio shows in 35 states.
Wow. Yeah. And you're doing one later today or tomorrow or?
Tomorrow I'm on KNUS, the Peter Boyle Show in Denver.
Yeah.
Peter is a very challenging talk show host because he will ask you questions out of left field, right field, and the bleachers. I mean, you never know what's coming. You could be talking about some obscure author who wrote a book on the World War II, you know. It's an amazing show, and I have to be on my toes.
which makes it fun, in a way.
It makes it fun. Yeah. It's a little jarring sometimes.
Gotcha. We've got a call here. Let's take that, and then we'll come on back and talk about defending the Constitution. But Lisa's listening, as usual, in Miles City, KMTA, 1050 AM. It's always a pleasure to have you on, Lisa. You're on the air on Voices with Rob Nadelson.
Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Rob.
One of the Miles City, one of the most underestimated places in Montana, I think.
Yeah. Great town.
Don't say anything.
I know.
It's a secret. But Tom always gets me to say things I would never say, I wasn't thinking or planning on saying with his questions. So it's a good thing, you know.
Yeah.
Well, I'm calling because I'm not against the Second Amendment. I'm not against guns. I have my own. Landlord hides them from me. But I am against criminals having guns. I'm for protecting children. You know, I don't have any children of my own, but I am very upset about the children that are getting hit in the crossfires.
Yes.
The Second Amendment gives rights to gun ownership, but it doesn't say anything about infringing on gun sales or manufacture. So could you explain to me how we can't, you know, talk or get our safety for our children so they can grow up in safely, and then as in conflict with the Second Amendment?
Yeah.
Good question.
It's a good question. Yeah. Second Amendment protects the right to keep and bear arms. What that means is the right to keep weapons that are commonly used in self-defense, that are bearable. In other words, we're not talking about naval ordnance here or atomic bombs, but weapons that can be carried. And the difficult issue in dealing with this or any constitutional right is how you square the constitutional right with the needs that people have for safety. Now, I don't think you can say you can go after the manufacturers or the distributors consistent with the Second Amendment. I'll give you an example. Let's say we said that anybody can run a conservative radio station, but no cable company should carry it. No cable company should deliver it. That would obviously be an attack on freedom of the press or freedom of speech, even though you weren't closing down the broadcaster itself. So you can't close the channels of distribution and supply. You can make it illegal, obviously, for people who committed felonies to own guns. You can make it illegal for people who have mental problems to own guns, and that's one area where I think that our state and local authorities have been lax. Mm-hmm. And you can also create environments where you have protection by people who are carrying. So, for example, every week in this country, crimes are aborted or prevented because you have some armed citizen who defended himself or others. You know, when I grew up, and I won't tell you how long ago that was, but I'll give you a hint. I was born in 1948. Kids were taught to use firearms. As a Boy Scout, I learned how to use a .22, and we weren't afraid of them. We treated them as with great respect and care, but we all learned how to use them. And I think that one of the problems we have, particularly in the cities and some of our more urban states, less so in Montana, is that people don't know much about firearms. They don't learn about them early on. And they really need to do so in the same sense that they learn how to drive a vehicle. So I think that's really where the answer lies. An armed citizenry, the arming of responsible, law-abiding people, helps to protect against violent crime. And there's no better example of that, frankly, than the state of Montana. My understanding is that that the average number of of guns per household in the state is somewhere in the order of 9, at least admitted. It's an exceptionally armed citizenry, but it tends to be a state with relatively low violent crime. So
there's a direct correlation there.
I think there is. Now, it is also true that there are other societies that have a lot of guns where there is violent crime. So it's not just all gun ownership. Right. You know, there's also things like community involvement, community control of people, recognizing people who are going to go off the handle or have mental problems. And that requires neighborly attention and so forth. That does tend to exist in Montana.
So the Constitution is sufficient in protecting our rights to bear arms and own guns, and as well as sufficient in providing for the public safety therein.
Generally speaking, I wrote an article about this for the Epoch Times, and compared the founding era with today as to what we knew then, what we don't know today. And generally, the Second Amendment came out pretty well if you apply it intelligently. But there's one thing that we've learned since the founding, which is really important, and that is that you can have governments that attack their own citizens and commit mass genocide. Holy and God. These don't have to be underdeveloped countries like Cambodia, right?
Right.
They could be highly sophisticated developed countries like Germany. And the way they get away with it is that they attack the unarmed citizenry or the disarmed citizens. So that kind of underscores, even more than the founders realized, the importance of an armed citizenry. If German Jews had been universally armed and trained in the use of arms, I think it's pretty safe to say that the Holocaust would not have happened.
It certainly would have been a different course.
And I think a much less bloody course.
Yeah. Rob Nadelson is with us here, Senior Fellow, Constitutional Jurisprudence, the Independent Institute. Again, search that. Good organization. I want to move on a little bit, but I got to conclude here before the break, defending the Constitution. And it's in line with this discussion here. Are we doing it well enough? If not, then why not? Or what do we need to do? And, if we look back and if we look forward, what's the
trend?
We'll
talk about that, Tom.
Well, no, do it. We got 2 minutes, I don't want to take the break right now because I want to come side of that and talk about the Supreme Court accepting this new Roe v.
Wade. Well, let me answer your question, okay?
Yeah. Yeah,
obviously, we're not defending the Constitution well enough, and I think one of the reasons for that is a lack of education on it. And I'll give you two examples. When I lived in Missoula, my daughter attended a local high school, and she was studying the Constitution in high school, and I asked her to bring home her book, and there were like three to five pages on the Constitution. And there were so many mistakes in those 3 to 5 pages that I actually wrote a memorandum. It was 3 pages, single-spaced memorandum to the teacher explaining all the errors and saying, you really shouldn't be using this book. I never got a courtesy of a response. But if kids are fed misinformation. Now, you might say, well, maybe they learn about it, let's say, in law school. Well, no, they don't. In the average constitutional law course, believe it or not, 2/3 of the coverage is devoted to 2% of the Constitution. Let me say that again. The average lawyer goes to law school, spends 2/3 of his course on constitutional law, studying 2% of the Constitution, basically the First Amendment and part of the 14th Amendment. And so there's a very high level of misinformation going on about the Constitution, even about the 2% that they do cover.
There are, though, new organizations that are out there defending it. I mean, it seems there's at least this recognition that if we don't do this now, we won't have a chance to come back and defend the Constitution as it is.
Yeah, a good example is the 10th Amendment Center. And I don't agree with everything that the 10th Amendment Center posts, but they really make an effort to do a good constitutional education. And they sometimes will include people with different points of view. 10th Amendment Center. National Constitution Center, on the other side, they tend to be much more into what the latest Supreme Court decisions are, and that the court decisions don't necessarily follow the Constitution as it was written. The Independence Institute, we have our Constitution Studies Center, which I administer. If you go to independenceinstitute.org, click on Constitution, you'll see a lot of essays about that.
I appreciate that. We'll take that break now and come on back. And as mentioned, the Supreme Court has a case in front of them that may lead, as some say, to a reversal. I guess the definition of reversal of Roe v. Wade could be determined here, too. But the court is going to weigh in again on the issue of abortion. We'll have more with Rob Nadelson in just a bit on Voices of Montana. All right. Again, it's a pleasure to have Rob Nadelson in studio, out visiting family in Montana. Comes out, I think it was about this time last year as well. And you're always welcome here and by phone. We appreciate your expertise. Let's talk about this, try to unpack this new case regarding a Mississippi law that seeks to ban most abortions after 15 weeks of pregnancy. The Supreme Court has decided they're going to take up this. Some say it could possibly lead to the reversal of Roe v. Wade. What say you?
I think it's very likely that it would. This is a law passed by the Mississippi legislature which banned abortion after 15 weeks of pregnancy, except in certain extraordinary circumstances. It sets up a direct attack on Roe versus Wade in a way that some other laws have not. I mean, some of the other laws that have gone before the court have involved such things as, you know, how many regulations or what regulations can be imposed upon an abortion clinic. But this case is designed to actually set up a potential for reversal of Roe. Roe versus Wade was decided in 1973. It overruled centuries of abortion criminal law. It effectively overruled the abortion laws of all 50 states, and it essentially legalized abortion nationwide on demand. It allows a few restrictions on abortion, but they're pretty minimal. As the Supreme Court says, any undue burden on abortion, meaning basically if abortion is in any way made inconvenient, then that's that gets struck down by the court.
That's been used as a sledgehammer for state rulings forever.
There are several problems here. I'm not going to get into the morality of abortion. I mean, there are people who are better qualified than I am to comment on that. But the cost to the court of the nationalization of abortion policy has been very high. All you need to do is look at the nomination hearings in Congress these days and to see what bloodfests they have become, largely because of abortion. In addition, nationalizing abortion policy and centering it in basically 5 out of 9 justices of the Supreme Court has made it impossible to work out democratically where we stand on abortion. On abortion, there are a lot of different arguments, pro and con. There are a lot of things to balance, and legislatures traditionally have done that. When Roe versus Wade was decided, you had states with liberal abortion laws, states with conservative abortion laws, all kinds of different formulas that were tailored to the needs and preferences of the particular state. Trying to have judges who are nothing but lawyers, really, experienced lawyers, decide abortion issues doesn't make any sense. I mean, you don't learn about abortion in law school. You know, you're not a medical doctor. There are no principles that really can be applied from a legal education to issues of abortion. And so the nationalization of the issue has been very divisive. It's been damaging to the credibility of the federal courts and particularly to the Supreme Court. And it has been very politically costly. So I think the court probably would seriously consider getting out of the abortion business and returning the issue to the states, which, after all, is one reason we have states.
Yeah, that's very interesting. In just 30 seconds here, the arguments in this case, I know we don't have enough time to discuss that, but what do you expect? Deep or surface?
Well, no, fundamental. I mean, it's going to be fundamental. Yeah. The Roe versus Wade is based upon the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment, and I think we're going to have a big argument about what that means. You know, I think that all the evidence indicates it has nothing to do with abortion, but obviously those people who are in favor of abortion are going to argue that it does. So it's going to be a very fundamental argument.
Good to see you. You look young, sir. You look young. You must be doing something right.
Yeah, I keep myself looking good for radio.
Yeah, nice. Good work. Rob Nadelson in studio. Take care. Well, I look forward to chatting again, okay?
Yep, absolutely.
So my
God bless Montana.
Amen. Amen to that. Thank you, Eric Young, our in-studio engineer. I'm Tom Schultz. You guys have a great day. We'll see you again tomorrow on Voices.